Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Sonia Quintanilla of the Cleveland Museum of Art in Ohio. We're talking about their art and stories for Mughal India, which goes on until October 23rd, 2016. We're still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please look for my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. Enjoy the podcast. So tell me about the Mughal?
Yes, Art and Stories from Mughal India.
Yeah, tell me about that exhibition.
So it's an exhibition that started with the idea that we would celebrate a new acquisition where we purchased the collection of Mughal and Deccan paintings, 95 works from the private collection of Catherine Glyn Bentheim and Ralph Bentheim. It's a collection I've known about my entire career. It's one of the most thoughtfully and importantly assembled works in a private collection,
right,
almost anywhere. The collection that was begun in 1961 and assembled by a scholar who really knew what she was doing. And
yeah.
So it's an incredible assemblage. So the Cleveland Museum of Art is really well known for having one of the finest holdings in arts of Asia, and also, especially in the field of the art of India, the sculpture collection is unparalleled with any other institution in this country in terms of just the percentage of high quality
right
in the collection and how it kind of spans the whole history of Indian art. But the painting collection is a little thin in comparison to the sculpture collection, and it's also a collection where, you know, there were really important individual works, but representative examples of kind of the entire trajectory of the history of Mughal painting wasn't fully filled in, and so the whole story of the Mughals couldn't really be told in a coherent way, and there just weren't enough numbers of paintings to support rotations that we now do to make sure that the paintings don't fade over time. So this was a major acquisition for the museum. And we started out by thinking we would celebrate it with a recent acquisitions exhibition, but then our centennial rolled around and there was a space on our calendar, and we thought, well, maybe we could expand the Mughal show and get some loans of some objects that will help bring the pieces to life and just make much more of a statement about this acquisition and about this art form that we thought people would enjoy.
Yeah.
And since it is our centennial, the other exhibitions that we've had or that we are having during this year are painting the modern garden featuring Monet and his garden paintings, big oil paintings, evil size and larger oil paintings. And then we had Pharaoh, King of Egypt, so ancient stone sculpture primarily. And the fourth one will be a contemporary works by a Swiss contemporary artist. So this is a way of featuring our own Asian collection, our own permanent collection, and a very different kind of art form and culture. These are mostly works on paper, brightly colored, so in small scale. So a really nice contrast to the other programming that we've offered during our centennial year.
Yeah, you got the best of all worlds.
I would say so. It's a nice balance.
Yeah. So these paintings, they tell a story of the Mughal India.
Right. So the way the exhibition is conceived, it does have a narrative and story emphasis. And so the main story that runs through the whole exhibition is the story of the Mughals themselves, how they wanted it told.
Mm-hmm.
So the way, the unfolding of the story of the Mughals and paintings made for the Mughals,
right?
Their own story. But then you step out into these spaces, I like to think of them as kind of veranda spaces, where you go into a brightly colored, brightly lit space where you can sit and you can listen to the kinds of stories that the Mughals themselves would have been told.
Mm-hmm.
So fables, adventure stories, anecdotal histories from the distant past, stories of mystics and holy men, the story of Jesus, an epic tale of the hero of Islam, or the romance of the prophet Joseph. So there are these four story features that are other stories that the Mughals would have told with paintings illustrated for them, mm-hmm. And helped bring them to life.
Cool. So, and you have...
Also gets to kind of the taste of the different emperors and patrons along the way.
Cool. So like the history and stuff too.
Right. And also what kinds of stories appeal to different personalities of different emperors.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. So I was looking, and you have, they're grouped in four groups. You have epics, you have fables, and you have mystic romance and sacred biography.
Yes.
Talk about some of them.
So one of the first one was fables, right? So that was, that's actually featuring a very important manuscript that is kept almost in its entirely here at the Cleveland, in its entirety here at the Cleveland Museum of Art. It's from a book of 52 fables called The Tales of a Parrot. And the frame story is that of a merchant's wife, mm-hmm. Whose husband has gone off out of town on an overseas business trip. She's home alone, and she's one day she's kind of lonely, and she's looking out the upper story window of her house down at the street, and she meets eyes with this handsome prince, and they fall in love.
Oh,
and they want to meet, you know, and,
right.
and start up a steamy torrid love affair. Anyway, so that night she asks her pet minor bird for permission to leave the house.
Uh-huh.
And the minor bird is female, and so she thought, well, the minor bird will be sympathetic to her cause. She'll know what it's like to be a woman left alone. And the minor bird says, no, you're a married woman. You
That's
shouldn't
not
break
right.
your vows. Don't do it. Resist the temptation.
Well, good
so
for her.
So Jasta, the wife, grabs the minor bird and dashes it on the ground and kills her. And then she turns to her pet parrot, and asks him the same question. And he was looking on and thinking to himself, I better come up with another tactic. And so every night she asks him, should I go out and meet my lover? And he said, absolutely, but just make sure. And then every single night he just drops a little hook of a strange and curious situation about a story, and she said, what do you mean? And she can't help but stay and hear the whole story to the very end.
Oh, that's clever.
She's beguiled, yes, to stay home all night. And so these are the stories that the parrot tells his mistress on 52 successive nights to keep her at home.
Oh, that's awesome. Good for him.
So he featured the story he tells her on the fifth night, and that one's selected because that particular story has illustrations with signatures in the margin, indicating that the names of the artists who painted them, and they happen to be artists that later become really famous as some of the most skillful masters of the imperial court and in this manuscript in their very first and earliest works. So those have been the most published in publications and the most famous. So I decided it was good to have those on view in a special exhibition.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the sacred biography happens to be the biography of the Christian Messiah.
Oh, cool.
And so I think this is something that it's you're coming in expecting to see a bunch of art and narratives that are completely exotic and foreign, and then you're surprised, I think, when coming upon this very familiar story of the life of Christ.
Right.
But it's the story of the life of Jesus like you've never heard it before.
Wow. Do tell.
So Akbar is the third Mughal emperor, and he was the one who was responsible for first establishing the empire as a powerful nation state that had and expanded its boundaries to include what's pretty much all of present day northern India and Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So he established not only the strength of the empire, but he also built up the painting atelier. He couldn't read, so he wanted lots of images and paintings.
Right.
For all of the books that he commissioned for his own library. And one of them that he's also extremely interested in religion and many different religions mm-hmm. and wanted to, even though he himself was a Muslim, he saw, for one thing, he was very aware of his position as an Islamic monarch at the time when Islam was going to be 1,000 years old, according to the Islamic calendar, the mm-hmm. Hijri calendar. So the millennium of Islam was falling during his reign. And there was a prophecy that there was going to be a great ruler who would renew the faith and reinvigorate it. Mm-hmm. And he saw that the way to do that was to look at the tenets of Islam and compare them with the tenets of other religions.
Right.
So he invited Hindu Brahmin priests and Jain monks and Sufi mystics and Sunnis and Shiites and to his court every single Thursday to engage in religious debate.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to kind of suss out what are the common threads through right. all of these different faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself came up with what he called the principles of what he just called a general divine faith.
Mm-hmm.
And he, so that is kind of this meta religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was really interested in Christianity. The Jesuit order, which was a very heavily missionary order, was founded just prior to the time of Akbar. And so the first Jesuit mission came to India.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three missions when Jesuit priests came to actually live at the court of Akbar. And one Jesuit missionary, his name was Jerome Xavier. He was a Spaniard.
Mm-hmm.
He came to the court of Akbar in 1595, and Akbar said, "Why don't you learn Persian and write for me a biography of the life of Jesus and mm-hmm. what was so great about him? You know, what were some of his miracles? What did he do?"
Right.
So it's not a New Testament. It's this one priest compendium of everything he knew about
uh-huh.
Jesus' life from the New Testament and also some other uh-huh. apocryphal sources. And he pulled together this story of the life of Jesus that is kind of a biography, a sacred biography, emphasizing miracles and emphasizing scenes that he thought would appeal to this emperor, this Islamic emperor of India, whom he was hoping to convert to
right.
Christianity.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really different plan. And then that book was taken by Akbar's son far away to this breakaway court he set up and was illustrated there.
Uh-huh.
And so those artists didn't have any source material. They didn't have any Bibles. They didn't have the priest there to ask. And so they selected what scenes they thought were interesting and painted them just as they were. And the descriptions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in Father Jerome's text. So there's no crucifixion. You know, there's a lot of scenes that we would normally find in the New Testament that aren't
right.
in this text,
uh-huh.
And a lot of really interesting scenes we might not ever have heard of before in the life of Jesus. So it's very interesting. It's nice to see a familiar story told from such a different perspective.
Yeah, I think that sounds really interesting. I think that sounds great.
And then there's the epic, which is scenes from the huge Persian epic, the Shahnameh, which is called the Book of Kings. And that also brings forward the Persian basis for a lot of Mughal literature and the books at Mughal court. So even though the Mughals, their own language was Chagatai Turkish,
mm-hmm.
they took on Persian as their court language, their official court language,
mm-hmm.
and they emulated Persian court culture. And so they did commission some works of the Book of Kings and had them illustrated in India.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, it really emphasizes the importance of Persian language and literature at this Indian court. So it's this multi-ethnic, multicultural
mm-hmm.
Basis for who the Mughals were. So it's not like they were totally bringing their own nationalist
right.
Ideas and culture and imposing it on India. They came into India, they adapted Indian things, they hired Indian artists, they married Indian women, and they adopted another kind of court language and literary theme from Iran. So another completely different culture.
Wow.
So it was a very, very vibrant and international.
Yeah. I think that sounds interesting. That sounds really great.
And then the fourth story is the romance. of the prophet Joseph and Zuleika. So a lot of people may have maybe familiar with Joseph from the Hebrew Bible.
In the Bible.
The Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph, the youngest son of Jacob, and he, you know, his older brothers were jealous of him, and they abducted him and threw him down a well, and some Egyptian merchants found him and sold him in the slave market in Egypt. So what the Islamic sources pick up on is the love affair and the, well, the crush, basically, that Zuleika had on Joseph. So Zuleika is mentioned in the Christian Old Testament as Potiphar's wife.
Yeah.
But in the Quran and then other Persian poets who latched onto the story and spun it out into a kind of a novel, she's referred to as Zuleika, and basically she had been having this recurring dream of a beautiful man, and they were going to have children together and be together. And even though she was married, she had this recurring dream.
Mm-hmm.
And when she went to the slave market and saw Joseph, she recognized him from her dream and purchased him and brought him home and, of course, tried to seduce him, but he never succumbed to her dances. But there are wonderful paintings and passages about her attempts.
I bet.
And then finally, decades later, her husband dies, and she's an old, blind, hunched-over woman.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph still retains his youth because of his virtue.
Right.
And finally, they're able to be together. She regains her youth, and they live happily ever after, and her dreams come true. So it's these really different moods, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of raucous, raunchy fables, and then, you know, curious fables with talking animals, and then, you know, the story of Jesus and the sacred biography with the hopes of conversion, you know, this is a conversion tale.
Right.
And then an epic, you know, this epic hero, the book of Kings, and then just romance with all its vicissitudes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds fascinating. That sounds really cool. Because, I know the story of Joseph, but I never heard it, you know, never heard it spun out that way. That's very cool. It's very interesting.
So I think, even though Mughal India is something that seems long ago and far away, I think a lot of visitors will be surprised at how very familiar many elements are, the characters, but also objects.
Mm-hmm.
So many things that are familiar to us are current and everyday in the Western world because of the Mughals and how open they were and diplomatic they were with trade. And
right.
It was the age of expansion, you know, the 1500s to the 1700s, when the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French were all going, the British, you know, going to India in search of tea and spices and textiles and jewels.
Right.
And the Mughals were very open to granting access to ports, and this was part of how they became so wealthy and influential.
Mm-hmm. The Dutch East India Company, right?
Yes, so starting in the early 17th century, the British East India Company. But the Portuguese had been there even in the 1500s, and the Dutch and the French too.
Yeah, I took a class and we talked about them, and I just thought that was so interesting. I didn't know, you know, that all that kind of stuff was going on back then. That's just
right. It's so funny, you know. We were just in Louisville, and with my family down in Louisville, Kentucky, and there was a Jane Austen festival, and we wandered in, and so many of the fashions, you know, it was all in costume, and so many of the fashions are derived straight from Mughal India.
Mm-hmm.
So early 19th century fashions, including, you know, the feathers and the hats and the wearing of turbans and shawls and the paisleys and floral textile patterns, they're all coming straight out of Mughal India.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's...
So you see them all over Europe and Britain and America.
Yeah. That's so cool. They're cutting edge.
Right. It's a great source of international influence and inspiration.
Definitely. So tell me your background. How did you get into the curating thing?
So I have my PhD in art history, the history of Indian art.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a PhD in Indian art, you're either going to be a professor of Indian art or a curator of Indian art. So life took me on the latter track. I used to teach in California. I was a professor part-time at UC Irvine, and I taught some courses in UCLA. And then cool. I was able to get the position as the curator of Asian art at the San Diego Museum of Art. And that's where I started curating exhibitions on Indian paintings, because they have an extraordinary collection there, mm-hmm. the Edwin Binney III collection of Indian paintings. So I was responsible for twice yearly rotations and drawing major exhibitions. And so it's been 12 years now that I've working with the challenges and wonders of this art form that's small in scale, you know, foreign in subject matter, and how to make it accessible and appealing to a broad, you know, Western audience. So I think we're able to harness all that experience and a lot of and all the resources that the Cleveland Museum of Art can put behind an exhibition and make something very welcoming and exciting.
Right, right. So which do you like better? Do you like teaching or curating better? Or they're both kind of, I mean, both kind of similar, I guess.
Although the great thing about curating is you get to spend time with original objects instead of photographs of objects.
Right.
So it's such an incredible privilege.
Yes, yes.
But it takes so much more time and money to get the same idea across. So it's like one gallery of an exhibition is kind of equivalent, I feel like, to an 1-hour lecture. For a class.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you can prepare an hour lecture in a couple of hours.
Right.
And then, you know, but it takes 6 months to put together a gallery rotation.
Right, right.
It conveys kind of the same information, but there's so much more that goes into caring for and mounting works of art. And it takes everything works in slow, kind of geological time, museum time, we call it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really cool. It sounds like you have the perfect job.
I would say so. I feel like I've landed that.
Right. I just think it sounds so cool to me just to be able to just kind of learn and just you know, just spend your time like looking at beautiful paintings and and just reading about them and learning about them. I think that's
right. Get lots of scholars who come and visit, and so there's lots of exchange of ideas. And I teach here also at Case Western Missouri University, the Department of Art History has a joint program with the museum, so I can always get my fix.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Sonia. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your interest.
And this has been great.
And have you had a chance to take a look at the exhibition app?
Not the exhibition app. I just saw that today, so I'm going to definitely check that out later on today.
So this exhibition app is something that we developed exactly for this show that would help people really enjoy it, I think, and get into the paintings.
Okay.
So there's audio where I walk you through all the stories.
Okay.
So the three main stories, I tell the whole story across the paintings and zoom in on the details of all the action.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 14 of the individual paintings, they just walk you through them. And then my favorite part is the 100 paintings, 100 facts, where there's a fun fact about a detail from each one of the paintings on view. That when you're going through, if you're going to a friend or something, you don't have to be stuck on your, you know, listening to a device. You can just say, okay, what's cool about this, and click on it, and then we have such incredible high-resolution photography. We could get tiny little details of something you probably would never notice, and then we can zoom in on it, and there's just a little comment by me on it. There's all different kinds of information, like this was owned by Winston Churchill's cousin, you know,
Cool.
As well as, you know, this is a tiny little thumb ring he wore on his left hand, which means left-handed.
Yeah.
So, you know, all kinds of information, and something that anyone can download anywhere, and it's going to be there in perpetuity since it's collection objects. We can always have it available. But it's a great way to experience the show.
Oh, experience,
I think it helps people see these paintings.
Yeah, and that's on clevelandart.org?
Yeah, well, you can get it from the App Store.
Oh, okay.
It's CMA Mogul. It's only for Apple devices.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's, iOS systems. So it's free on the App Store.
Cool.
If you search for CMA Mogul.
Okay. Cool. Well, awesome, awesome. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate this. This was great.
Oh, thank you.
Sonia Quintanilla of the Cleveland Museum of Art for telling us about the Art and Stories from Mughal India exhibition. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Cleveland area, check out the museum. They've got a lot of great stuff going on. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have any ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. That's all one word and Brooke with an E. Thanks for listening.
Let's Talk Art with Brooke is a Hotspur Enterprises media production.